Great. Well, thanks so much for being here, Kim, and agreeing to share your story with William and I today. We're really looking forward to hearing a bit about your story. Just to get started, could you tell me a little bit about your connection to Vancouver?
I grew up in Vancouver, so born and raised in Vancouver, lived in East Vancouver, North Delta, Surrey, Burnaby, East Vancouver, West Side, West End. Yeah, anyway, Vancouver. So, except for a couple of years that I lived in Los Angeles and a few years that I lived in the interior of BC. I'm 49, and 40 years of those were spent in Vancouver, the first 40 years, so.
Wow. And how about your connection to the gay community? How did you first start getting involved in the gay community or in gay life?
To tell you the truth, I that was very, I wasn't really involved in the gay life as a young person that much. I was very involved in the music community, the punk rock music community of Vancouver, which, maybe historically it was very queer positive or had a lot of crossovers, but by the time I was in that, it was still not the most queer positive scene to be a part of. But of course, I always knew about what was going on. It was gay in Vancouver because you'd go downtown to see shows, and a lot of the shows would be sometimes at gay bars, and some of the stores that we crossed over would have, gay content. So I knew about gay culture as I was kind of like curious about, but I never got to be involved in the gay community as such until I started, first volunteering at Youth Co AIDS Society when it first started. And that's because it hit more of my, the AIDS activism really hit my politics. I was very politically active in the punk community, and that I liked. As you possibly might, can imagine, the gay community was very dance music orientated, and I was very punk music orientated, and it just didn't attract me in many ways. Having said that, I think I came out, when I was about 23, and by the time I was 24, I was already had HIV. So I quickly was way more involved in the HIV/AIDS community, and I really liked the HIV/AIDS community because I was meeting people who were politically active and creating a real sense of community rather than just going to a club or a bar. Having said that, going to my first gay bar when I was 23 or 22 was, I was celebrities, and I was shocked to be in a room with that many people that were gay because otherwise it was very secretive for me. It was, I did go to like Gab Youth Services at the time, which is now community, and stuff like that, and walked around the block a couple times before I walk in because I was like, I don't know if I belong here. Everyone's gonna see me, type of thing. And well, again, while I went and did those things, it wasn't like I met gay punk rockers. So I quickly kind of got involved in Youth Co AIDS Society, and for myself, it was about how could I queer the punk rock community by being a very vocal person in the scene that was out and talking about being gay. So that was kind of my sort of channeling of like, okay, if I don't see myself in the gay world, then how do I bring in the gay world to my world and say that, we can take up the space. And so I looked at it that way. It's sort of like, what can you get inspired by one part of a community and take it to another part of your community and build something new. I think that was that involvement I had in the punk rock community was a lot around all ages shows and making sure that not making sure, but being really involved in organizing youth-oriented events that were all ages shows. Not because a lot of punk rockers got old and just played bar shows. So I created this co-op called the Just Quest Co-op, which put on all ages shows in Vancouver that were like non-racist, non-sexist, non-homophobic, and that was a big part of the kind of music community of the sort of like early 90s, and I think that's why Youth Co. I really liked when I started volunteering and working with them. That's one of the things they were really attracted was that I had such involvement in youth activism.
No, that's really interesting. I mean, I think a lot of the folks that we've talked to, their like initial kind of community connection was with the gay community, and it sounds like that was like a later connection for you, and that music was really that first kind of community that you found yourself like really immersed in.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Ever since I was 14. So
that's cool.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I did. Historically, the punk community actually was very gay, had lots of, it just, when it got more and more popular, it became very white, suburban, male, macho kind of stuff. But I mean, early punk rock scenes were actually weirdos, freaks, and geeks, and queers, and everything. So, I mean, there really was, an interesting history there. It just, over time, kind of, the voices kind of subsided.
Mm-hmm.
But,
And then
I think there's actually probably a lot of gay people who, like, you know, came out of the gay community, but they're like, I don't really identify with the gay community. I always say there's a difference between gay actions and gay identity. And there's a lot of people who love gay sex. I mean, talking to, as a cis male, that, you know, like to have sex with other guys and see themselves as being gay, but, you know, don't actually identify what is seen as the gay identity of what the gay community is, which may be about what kind of music you wear, what kind of fashion you wear, and that, and what social circles you are. So, you know, I don't think my story is actually unique. I just think often when people say that we're gay, they just assume that means you're part of the gay community, as opposed to like that you kind of come in at sideways. You're a part of the gay culture, but not necessarily about always a part of the gay community. Yeah. Right. We all have different communities. We're not all one community. I mean, we're all multifaceted community members. So,
of course, you know. Yeah. And it's partially about where we like draw the boundaries of those communities. If the gay community is just this little bubble in the West End, then a lot of us aren't part of that community, right?
Totally. I mean, I remember early on when I was, you know, I was a very, you know, whatever, researchy minded kid. Anyway, so when I was looking about my, like, I questioning my identity, you know, there was this, you know, book, what was the book I read? I think it was called, I Thought People Like That Killed Themselves, and it was a history of different people who were gay, throughout history that, you know, had been, their stories had gone untold, and the quote was from, like, I don't know, one of the kings who was found out that his jester was gay, and anyway, but the point of the matter was, there were some interviews in there, and there was one guy in there I totally identified with, who thought, oh, I'm going to come out to this gay community, and everyone else is going to be, like, understanding all the different oppressions of the world, just like I see, you know, racism and sexism and classism and homophobia, all together intertwined. And then I, you know, got to this gay Gab Youth Services and found out a lot of the kids there wanted to have all their same privileges and issues, and they didn't want to look at them. They just wanted to be gay and do that. And I was like, oh, I have a much larger political agenda than this. Mm. So, you know, that, you know, that's just, you know, is where people are sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad I found the AIDS community.
Yes. Yes. Cause that was a very politically focused community, especially back in, you know, this earlier period of the epidemic.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't positive until, what was it, 95? But, you know, ACT UP was already existing, and there was a lot of activism around, you know, whether it just be around trying to do more research for clinical trials or to get access to medications. And it was like, it was fun, you know, and really interesting. So, you know, people that were involved in HIV/AIDS activism, it wasn't just a desk job. It was like, what are we going to do to, like, shake up foundations of this world who is absolutely, like, ignoring us, and we're dying. So what are we going to do? You know? And then that was cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, cool, not that people are dying. Cool that people were taking that action.
Yes. And it sounds like, you know, ACT UP was also, you know, an organization that was very much focused on these intersectional levels of oppression, and that would have jived with your politics.
Yeah.
So do you remember when you first heard about HIV?
Oh yeah. I mean, I was like a young kid. So yeah, I mean, I probably was like 11 or 12 or something like that. So it was kind of like through the media, you knew it was like some kind of gay disease, is really what this, you know, it had come out as being as such. And then of course, I mean, when I was really young, it was just, people kind of, it was just a derogatory joke that gay people were dying, you know, because we're just, homophobia was just so pervasive, myself included. I mean, I didn't think I was gay when I was a kid. There was just this whole, I wasn't so politically aware as a young child. I was just as much of a jerk as anyone else could be. And, I can totally remember, ironically, being at a pharmacy with my one of my sisters and my dad, and there used to be a diet pill called AIDS, AYDS, and I remember going, "Oh, I've got AIDS," and making a joke, and my sister was like, "What is AIDS?" to my dad or something like that, and you know, me being snarky and saying something like, "Oh, that's just, you know, a disease that gay people get and die," and you know, I remember that totally. Of course, you know, the irony, like another 12 years later is, you know, hits harder at home. But, you know, over time, you know, it became very aware that, you know, this, you know, was preventable. I even did AIDS Vancouver, like, taught, like, a course at, I was a part of this thing called Youth Corps, where it was a job creation program to environmentally work and, like, build paths in some of the parks of Vancouver, and part of it was we had to get education, stuff like that, and AIDS Vancouver did, like, a workshop with us around HIV and stuff. We never had it in high school, so that's for sure. I don't remember anything about that, but, you know, when, you know, Rock Hudson, we found out that he had HIV, and you know, later on Freddie Mercury, you know, an Easy E, like, oh my God, like, I mean, it was just like that, those things like that, you know, really, you know, hit people at home. And then it was sort of like, why are we doing anything about it? Like, it was, you know, by that time I was getting older, right? So then it was like, you know, I remember watching the Oscars and everyone had these little red ribbons, and I was like, everyone's wearing these red ribbons, but no one's even saying the word AIDS. No one would risk saying the word AIDS. And I was so upset that people were silent. That was their protest, was wearing a ribbon on stage. And that was seemed like a monumental moment. Yet I was like, that's not enough. Like, I was just like, that's crazy. You know, like, that was probably like late 80s. And, you know, it wasn't like the dialogue, you know, was when I was young and I was 12, like I was telling you about, it was new. We didn't know much. You know, this is like years later and there was still no movement. It was so ridiculous. It wasn't, you know, as a person who didn't identify with the gay community and it was still having to figure out his sexuality, I can see how ridiculous it was. It was just like, this is just homophobia. This is just, you know, homophobia, you know, class phobia against drug addicts and people of color as well. It was just like, oh, these are the people we don't care about. The Reagan era was so, such a parallel to what we see going on right now, where you just see absolute, you know, bigotry, just, you know, unrestrained, and it seems like it doesn't get a mark on these people for saying those things. So, you know, punk rock music did very well because there was so much to rally against in the 80s because of all this shit, and the punk rock community was very aware of some of these politics. So, again, I may not have been out, but I was quite aware.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And most of that awareness, as you said, was like coming through like the mainstream media at the time.
The punk rock community, I mean, had a lot of awareness about politics, so I read a lot in alternative punk magazines about, you know, some of the issues kind of going on and questioning that. But the mainstream, you know, you could just see how hypocritical it was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he said that in terms of like sex education in school, like that just was not part of the equation, HIV.
I do not even know what went, like, I never saw an HIV education in my youth. No, that didn't exist. I mean, there was talk maybe when I was, I mean, when I did a sex education course, probably in elementary school, like grade 7 or something like that, you know, I would have been like 12 years old. So that would have been like 83. You know, nothing about HIV was really known then to be able to bring that up. And there wasn't really that many follow-up sex ed courses. I don't think there ever was in my school. I'm just trying to think. And again, I didn't really learn anything about HIV until I was already graduated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of like was there information out there around safe sex, for example?
Again, I mean, the sex education I would have got when I was a kid was just about really preliminary, like, this is how a guy and a girl can have a baby, and I don't even know if it touched on birth control. Like, it was really preliminary. I mean, really preliminary. I mean, definitely did not talk about STIs beyond, I mean, okay, HIV, that wasn't even on the table then in the early 80s for them to talk about, let's say. They didn't know what it was. But, there was no such thing as sex ed. Mm-hmm. I grew up. And so I would have been in, by that time, I moved around a lot. That would have been in North Delta. I didn't have any sex education that talked about STIs or actual, you know, mention anything besides abstinence and how to not get someone pregnant. I mean, it was very, definitely very puritanical or Christian based, probably. Don't talk about sex, otherwise you're promoting sex type of thing. So, you got education from your friends. Mm-hmm.
And how about as into the late 80s and 90s, was there more information available to you, like not necessarily through school, but elsewhere at the time?
I mean, I knew YouthCo was doing some stuff, and that's why I kind of got involved with them. And then we basically would do shows, some punk rock shows where there would be like tables with information from YouthCo and stuff like that. But other than, making that space available, I think the band I was in was called Spark Marker, and we were kind of like, and then we did a lot of all ages shows. We did a benefit show for BCPWA. It didn't raise money, because they were trying to run it like a big gay gala, and they didn't understand that punk rock kids didn't want to pay $30 at the door to see an event. They wanted to pay like $6, so they lost money. But that was the first time. God, I wish I remember his name. I don't. One of the guys from BCPWA was like, "Oh, that's really cool that you're doing that. Have you ever met someone who's living with HIV?" And I was like, "No, actually, I just thought I'd do this." And then he's like, "Well, I am." And I remember being like, "Whoa! Like, this is the first person I've met with HIV." Having said that, interestingly enough, in time going on later, one of my best friends wrote music for an AIDS song in Vancouver. This is like, late 80s. And I don't know how I didn't know how he got involved in it, but it was like in the paper or something. So I was like, "Dude, what was this?" And it was so interesting because he was so secretive about it. And I was putting out a record for his band because I had this record label when I was in high school. He was so vague about it. Like, I couldn't figure it out. Years later, of course, being a member of YouthCo and being positive, there was this girl named Keisha, and Keisha was the sister of my friend, Keith. And so I then realized, he knew that she was positive back in the day, was trying to maintain her anonymity. And so he didn't tell me about it. And, here it comes full circle where, we actually hired her brother to DJ one of our YouthCo Christmas events. And, I'm talking to Keith and it's just like, what a weird irony that happened back in the day. Not back in the day, it wasn't that long ago, to tell you the truth. Probably like 6 or 7 years earlier, and our lives come full circle in this really weird way. But people were still not wanting to disclose other people's HIV status because there was a sort of discrimination and fear. Death marketing around HIV and AIDS got everyone scared, and so people wouldn't want. There was a lot of misinformation around. Being around someone who's HIV positive. I mean, even though I was, let's say, cool with that, when I met that guy from BCPWA, I was like, whoa, I've never met someone. I mean, the only time I'd seen that was people on TV or, and Princess Diana holding, a little kid with HIV. And you're like, that was, risk taking because there was so much unknown in the beginning. And even though we got more information going on, you still carried that fear of the unknown with you. Cause it was just so, it was so scary in the mid 80s. It was, no one knew what it was. No one knew how you got it. And all you knew is you died. You didn't even, it was just so bizarre. I can't quite explain how in the dark we were, even when information came out, and how hard it was to get the information out because there were so many roadblocks about talking about sex or talking about drugs. It was just, you couldn't talk about those subjects. So how can we talk about it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And of course, even then, when information does start getting out, it doesn't necessarily eliminate all of the fear, like you said. Like the.
I think, yeah, it's like once you've already learned the message of fear, what I call like death marketing, marketing death to people and giving them fear, even though they get information, they're still at their core having to erase that message that's in their brain that they first received, which was fear-based. And it's just such a fear. Fear-based marketing is just so strong. It's really hard to record over it because even though people know it's not right, it's still instinctually they're afraid. And I think it takes a while for people to change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how did you first start getting involved with YouthCo?
They did some show. And I can't remember which one it was. And they did an outreach table, and they had like, I don't know, like a free snowboard or something like that, that they were giving out their table to get people to come to their table to get information. And like I said, I was in a band, and so very politically active. And I was like, you know, by that time, you know, I think, yeah, but, you know, it was a very small window of me like coming out publicly as being gay. I was like, you know, 23. And then by the time I'm 24, I have HIV. So things changed in a real small window. Like I was very quickly out of the closet and then back into an HIV closet. And I say back into an HIV closet because you legally couldn't cross the border as a person living with HIV being disclosed up until 2008. So I was a very vocal advocate for being a gay man in my music community, and I mean, that was shocking for a lot of people back then because bands just didn't do that. People didn't do that in bands in the 90s. And to come out about being positive, while I really liked the idea of it, I spent most of my time, when I was in a band, we were touring the States all the time. So the idea of me having anything on record saying that I was living with HIV and that can be used against me to cross the border, I was like, no, absolutely not. Like, that just cannot. I talk about it with my friends. People knew, but I wouldn't be public about that. I did some public stuff to tell you the truth. Like, my photos are out there and stuff like that. But you wouldn't see my name saying I'm living with HIV type of thing. I was very cautious. I felt like I had to be, you know. Even when I moved to Los Angeles, I didn't move to Los Angeles until, like, 2007. And I was like, fuck, like, you know, I'm going to be working down there. How is this going to happen for me to get a work visa and I'm not to find out? And I was paranoid the whole time until I got my work visa. And I was happy that they didn't do a blood test. But then I was looking at being a citizen in the States and, you know, that change didn't happen until 2008, 2009. And I had already decided to leave in 2009. But I was already looking at lawyers about how to become a permanent resident in the States. And it was like, there was no way of me doing it without paying somebody else to do my blood work. And I was like,
wow,
I'm just not that type of person, man. Like, I can only lie so much. I really like being who I am and not having to watch what I say because I don't want to be duplicit. It just takes energy. And I was just like, wow, I have to fake marrying a girl and then I have to have someone fake doing my blood work and pay somebody. I was like, that's fucked up. I just came from a country where it's okay for me to be positive and it's okay for me to be gay and marry someone at the same time and then live in the States where I was like traveling back in time. I didn't like it. But anyway, so yeah, I your question, sorry, I just went off on a tangent and I do this very well. I talk a lot. your question was YouthCo, I think it was, like, how did I find out about YouthCo? So they were doing an event at an all-ages show, and I started talking to them. And at that time, YouthCo, like, I didn't even know if they had a staff member. Like, Chris Buckner was the first staff member, the first Chris Buckner they hired. And in the beginning, it was just run by volunteers. You know what I mean? It was absolutely just all volunteer run. And all the board members were volunteers who were doing the workshops. So, like, you know, then when they got funding to hire people, and Christopher Barnes, actually, and Josephine were hired, I think, in September of 95, they got their funding. And that's actually when I found out I was positive. And by December, Christopher decided he didn't want to do it, actually. And so he was only worked for like 3 months, and they were just getting started. And he was like, yeah, actually, you know, I don't want to do this. And so then I was like, you're hiring. I'm going to apply for this job. It's a part-time job. And boom. Yeah. You know, I got interviewed by every single member of their board. It was hilarious. I walked into the room. I had no idea. And every single member of their board member was there, and each single person took an interview, had an interview question. I mean, they were completely non-hierarchical at that point. I know YouthCo changed how they did, but it was completely non-hierarchical, completely peer-driven, youth-driven. You know, I really loved their politics 100%. I thrived in it. So, but it was funny to walk into an interview and realize there was a room of people, and every single one of them was asking me a question, taking turns. So that started that part of that journey for me. And that was, Chris Buckner was executive director. Josephine Stubbings was the other, peer outreach worker. That's what I was at the beginning, was an outreach worker. And then Tasca Cavero was our education person. And then Ian, what's Ian's last name? Gardner was, Ian Gardner was our education person. Todd, I think, was our volunteer coordinator. I don't remember the original, that was the original group there. So that was very interesting. And, yeah. And so, like, we've worked with the board very closely because they were basically training the staff. And so we had a really close relationship. And, you know, we knew the founding members of YouthCo because they were youth. So that was like Leighton Schneller, Greg Eads, and Patrick McIntyre. They were the ones that, like, thought of the idea of YouthCo. And, you know, they trained us, you know, for some of the stuff that we needed to do with the other board members. And it was a really, really, really close. That was when we were on Hastings Street. And then we had to move, and then we moved on to Pender Street. But yeah, that was a really, we did everything together. It was a really, really, really interesting time. It was really focused that, of course, all the youth that they hired wouldn't have experience to be working at a nonprofit because we're all youth. So we were all getting trained as much as we could get trained by other youth or any other workshops. And then the dynamic changed where all of a sudden the staff had more knowledge than the board. And then that changed the dynamic on how organization ran, because the board kind of then felt like they weren't needed. And so it was a really weird shift because, you know, they were really needed because we had no staff, and then they were needed to train the staff. And then within a couple of years, the staff were like the experts, and the board were kind of doing more just policy stuff, and they were kind of bored. So there's a shift in the board then too.
I mean, that sounds like a successful, like, that sounds like they successfully kickstarted an organization if they actually kind of were, you know, they trained people to such an extent that they had more expertise than they did.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They did a great job. I mean, and for myself, I mean, I was just a working class guy. It's like, you know what I mean? I worked in, like, factories and warehouses and stuff like that. So for me, that really jump-started me to be able to, like, work in an office space and to be advocating for youth. And and I loved it because it was very, you know, we had very strict, you know, parameters of what the policy was of the organization. So, I mean, it was like, if a member of our group didn't feel inspired by a project that someone proposed to us, because everyone would be like, oh, we want to get youth on board. And we'd be like, does anybody in this room want to do this project? And if someone did, then we would do it. But if no one was interested in the project, then we'd just say, wow, that's really nice. Thanks for the offer. But we're a youth-driven organization, and that idea is not youth-driven. That's an idea that came from an adult, and it's probably, maybe it's a good idea, but for us, where we're at, we're growing at the pace that we need to grow at, and that is, sadly, we're going to say no. And, you know, because God, everybody wanted youth to do everything, and wanted the youth voice everywhere so they could say that they were representing youth. And, you know, it was sort of like, well, we want to make sure that we're taking care of our youth and that we're not just, you know, over-exploiting our youth unnecessarily, you know, had to be driven by that. So I flourished well in that environment. I mean, we were non-hierarchical, so we all got paid the same, and we all, there was no, like, anyone was higher or more better than any other person. And that became a challenge for people, I think, over time. And later on days, people came into the organization and didn't like that idea that an executive director should get paid the same amount as an outreach worker or something like that. I don't know. I guess I'm quite the socialist, and I do well in that. I love consensual, and it was consensus decision making too. Everything was consensus. So we couldn't get consensus. We didn't do it. Mm-hmm. So for a lot of people, that was a very frustrating organization to work with. I loved it.
And what did your role look like there in terms of the work that you were doing?
It was building a youth organization for youth living with HIV, because none of that existed. So in the beginning, it was just like, we know of some people who are living with HIV that we're friends with, because, you know, some of the people volunteering there were youth. But it was like, how do we reach the other youth who aren't here? And they're not going anywhere else, and they may not know that we exist. So my background through the punk rock world was doing graphic design and putting out records and putting out posters and putting on shows and promoting things and marketing things. So, you know, what I brought to the table, I guess, was marketing our group in the Georgia Strait at that time was a very, like, free newspaper. It was thick, and everyone read it. And so we would advertise in Georgia Strait, because that was a real general free magazine that went everywhere throughout the city. And then we would also advertise, obviously, in Extra West. And then if there were, like, you know, like, youth groups that had some kind of, like, publication sometimes, or a pamphlet, you know, like something that they would do, we would try to, you know, we had a budget to, so if, like, just say, like, you know, Urban Native Youth was doing some sort of, like, brochure thing of the year, and we'd say, oh, can we do a page in that to promote our thing? Or, you know, we would also do outreach at their events, so that people, you know, if youth were coming there, let's say, that was on Hastings and Maine-ish area at the time, you know, like, say, Josephine would be there and just involved with their activities. But if one of the, you know, workers there said, oh, I know this person's, you know, positive, can I refer them to you? Then they could have a confidential conversation out somewhere else. And if that's all that they did, that's all they did. But if they want to, they could come to our organization, which, you know, was kind of like in the middle of the downtown East Side and West End, right? Because we were at Hastings and like Richards area. And then so what we were doing was just creating, you know, created a little database where we, you know, had everyone's name. And then if we had a phone number for them, we had a phone number for them. Not many people had emails back then. And it was pretty much, you know, phones. And then what, as we would have an event, you know, we would basically have like a once a month dinner. I think it was on a Thursday or something like that. And then we would have, try to do, like, you know, like a daytime kind of like movie watching thing, I think on Fridays. And then we'd have retreats. Retreats are the big one, right? Like, you know, once a year we'd have a retreat. And so with that database that, we collected, we would, if we had a phone number, then I would phone them like once a week and say, hey, how's it going? You know, like in the beginning, there was like 20, you know. By the end, when I left, we had about 120 youth that were on that database. So it took a while to find everybody, but it was very personal. It was like, hey, you know, these are the events that are going on. And even if they didn't come, it didn't matter. We were just checking in with them like at least once a month, you know, ideally like once a week if there was stuff going on. It depends on how busy we were with other things. Like, you know, I mean, selling a retreat. I know, I've done telephone soliciting. You're just like, hey, we have this great event. It's free. You get to go away for 3 days. It's all expenses paid. You'll be able to stay there. You'll be there with other, you know, it was just like selling youth this opportunity to go away. And, you know, it was very specifically that we had, you know, a woman and a guy working as the outreach workers so that, you know, we at least, you know, had some gender representation. And, we're just very conscious of, you know, and then, you know, we made a pamphlet. That was our first pamphlet for our positive youth outreach program, which, you know, tried to have that we aimed to have diversity in the photos so that, you know, people who were either comfortable having their faces in it or it was just their hands or whatnot. The first brochure was, I'm not going to say it was the most beautiful brochure, but, you know, it was just trying to, you know, promote, you know, diversity of what positive youth looked like. And so we did as much outreach. We had our dinner events. I mean, we would have guys and girls, straight and gay, from the street or privileged, all coming to our dinners. We wouldn't have more than 12 people. Like, I mean, we maybe in the end had 120, you know, people in that database by the time I'd been there for 5 years. But like, you know, you wouldn't get more than 12 people, you know, at an event. You know, I'd say 8 would be your average, you know what I mean? And then if you were lucky, maybe, you know, 14 or something like that. But it was a very mixed group. And, you know, looking at it, you know, back, it was just a place for people to meet their partners, you know what I mean? You know, whether you're gay or straight or male or female, you're just looking for somebody that you can date. So, you know, it just ended up being a place where youth can meet other youth who are living with HIV and start relationships. And, you know, and then they kind of keep hanging out. So we used to always joke that we're really just, we're creating a dating site is all we were doing. But, you know, having food was what we needed to do to bring people together. We'd have retreats, which would really bring the people together. And the retreats we did in the beginning were out in the interior at, there was like a First Nations, First Nations circle, it was like a First Nations healing retreat, I guess is what I would call it. I'm forgetting the name. It only lasted for a couple of years. So we did that for a couple of years, and we had, you know, elders teach us, you know, sort of the interior First Nations way of healing. And you know, they were also open to having HIV-positive youth come out there. And then we did a couple on the Sunshine Coast where we were able to find a space and actually still maintain a connection with a sweat lodge on the Sunshine Coast. So we were always able to maintain being able to be aware of our First Nations youth and our ability to see if we could, you know, foster that knowledge and creating that space. So that was really unique. I mean, that was like, we lucked out with that, even finding that first healing retreat space. It was by Falkland, and now I think it's a retreat center. Like, it got sold. Like, you know, I mean, the same people don't run it. I've just driven by there and know that that's, I know that that's what it is now. I don't know who's involved in it. But, yeah, you know what I mean? Like, I was a punk rock kid. I was used to, like, getting a van load of kids and traveling across North America and sleeping on people's floors and going to New York City. So, like, you know, getting a bunch of kids in a van and going into the interior for a healing retreat, you know, sure. We had a lot of, like, different needs of people that, you know, were at different places in their lives. But overall, you know what? Like, we would always stand back and say everyone was taking care of everybody. You know, it wasn't just like the gay guys were here and the street people. If I'm going to, you know, divide into two groups, you know, the folks in the downtown east side and the gay guys in the west end. It wasn't like there were just two separate groups. Like, everyone really tried and really had a really big heart of helping each other out. And at the time, too, like, drugs hadn't been available like they are today. Like, it was a crazy transition. We started, and, you know, I mean, I had clients who when I say clients, I mean members of YouthGo and our Positive Youth Outreach Program, who they were gone. Like their family had written, they had everything signed off, and then these new protease members came out and they came back to life. It was insane. Not that that happened with everybody, but that happened, and it was just like, holy fuck, man. It was bizarre. I mean, and people still died and overdosed and everything else too. I'm just saying it was a really interesting mix. And I was a part of a lot of different studies, because when I seroconverted, I actually wasn't HIV positive. I was actually HIV negative, and I was seroconverting, and my doctors figured that out. So then I became like a lab, you know, like, they're like, we have this young kid who's like in the window of conversion. And so we're going to like, basically put me through every test that they possibly could. And I was jumped onto every study really quickly. So I was like one of the first people of that YouthGo crowd that started taking protease inhibitors, because people were like, what are these things? And I was like on a study for it, because I was like, well, I mean, if I'm going to die anyway, I might as well do something for science. So I'll try these drugs. And, you know, I dealt with them fine. So, you know, a lot of people were like, they're okay, Kim? And I was like, yeah, I've been taking it for like 4 months now. My numbers dropped and I feel fine. There's no side effect. Because I had done AZG and all that other stuff. I was like, no, I will never do that. I was like, fuck, I hated those drugs. You know, for 2 weeks, I said, no way. And then, you know, I was sort of like one of the, what do you call it? When the big AIDS conference of, I think it was 95 or 96, came out, and they were presenting in Vancouver all the work about protease inhibitors, you know, like I was one of the people that was in one of those studies that was like, they were like, look at the great results we're getting. So it was a really weird changing time. I went from like being in waiting lists, when I found I was positive, or I found out that I had we did the P24 antigen test, as my doctor did, because my white blood cells were so low. So my test came back negative, and then he said, oh, I did the P24 antigen test because I'm concerned that you had a risky sex and your white blood cells are low. And so I said, yeah, okay, great, I'm glad you did that. What's the results of that? He's like, I can phone and find out. And then, you know, he phoned, and they said, oh, it's reactive. And they were like, he was like, reactive, so that's definitive? And they were like, yes. And I'm like, well, so I don't get this. What's this P24 antigen test? I knew the HIV antibody test. And so, and he's like, you have HIV, like your body hasn't even created the antibodies yet. Like you're seroconverting as we speak. And I was floored, of course. But then I was thrown into all this, you know, into all these, tests and whatnot. And I was in waiting rooms with people who were at death's door. So like, you know, when I had to do my blood work at the IDC Center in St. Paul's, which was in the basement at the time, I remember just being in shock because I was sent there right away and saying like, yeah, I'm like 24 and I just found out that I have HIV and I'm just in shock. And I remember the nurse just like broke down and left. She just started crying, and another nurse had to come in and do my blood work because she was just like, just, I wasn't even that emotional. I was just in shock. Because it was a death sentence, you know, it was like, yeah, you know, I wasn't working at YouthGo at the time. It wasn't until 3 months later that I was working at YouthGo. My job at the time, they were like, we've got to put you on long-term disability. We've got to get this for you. Like, you know, they were like I worked at this workers' co-op, which was like, you know, a workers' co-op. It was very socialist, hippy-dippy, gay-friendly place. It was called Horizon Distributors. It's a big company now, but it used to be a co-op. And they were, like, as helpful as they could be, because they lost a lot of their friends. And they were like, holy shit, this kid's positive. Wow, what can we do for him? Like, I know. And then quickly, just for me, it just turned into, all right, I'm going to work for YouthGo. And let's do that, you know. And see what we can do to change the world. That's, you know, it kind of shifted. But yeah, going to those appointments and being like young and 24, and my health was still fine because I was just seroconverting, but being in a room with like, you know, 10 or 12 other people who were, you know, really, really frail and really, really sick because they wanted to, you know, get my tests started off so we had a, you know, a baseline for, you know, everything from checking my eyes to my lung, you just name it, man, we did it. And I'm not pissed off about it. I was just saying it was scary. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because seeing people that were, you know, further along in the virus's progression was like a glimpse into the future.
This is where I'm heading. It was just like, what? Holy, this is where I'm going to be? Like, and then I just, I don't know. Actually, the first thing I did after that is I went to the Pacific AIDS Resource Center and went to the library because that's just very information knowledge kind of guy. Want knowledge. I was like, all right, I just found out that I have HIV. I want to know what, you know, drugs are available to me. I want to know what the life, the typical, what, you know, what kind of longevity can someone expect living with HIV? Like, what, with the current, you know, state of things, what kind of a lifespan could I have expect for my outlook? I really like to have an outlook. And at the time, from the research that I could find out, there was, you know, a few people who they didn't know why, but they, you know, the longest person at that time living with HIV documented had lived 17 years. And I was like, well, I was like a vegan, vegetarian, real health nut. And I was like, well, if I'm good at this, you know, maybe 15 years, like, because 17 is obviously doing pretty well, but who knows, like, what that, what's going on with that guy genetically. So I'm just going to, like, optimistically say 15 years. And I just held on to that 15 years. Like, I got 15 years to do everything I want to do. And so that's how I dealt with that trauma. I needed a timeline and I held on to it. It didn't work out so well when I hit 15 years later. I actually had a meltdown in my life, a little bit of a personal breakdown, but because I was wrong and I kept living and didn't know how to live my life past 15 years. But that's another story.
And where did you find, I mean, I think you kind of already mentioned some of this, but like, where did you find support initially when you found out about your HIV status?
I just jumped into Youth Co. Like, yeah, I found out I was positive in September, and I think it was October, there was the BC HIV conference or something like that, like not the world, not the international conference, but the BC conference. And so yeah, I guess that would have been 95. And I just went to that. I just wanted information. I was just like, I need information. I need to absorb as much information. I just started dating this guy and he was very supportive. And I just was like, I need to get as much information if I'm going to survive this. That was it. And I'm not saying that was the best way of doing it. I just jumped in with both feet and was like, all right, what can we do to, you know, change this and make this better? Youth Co. had a dinner in November, I think, because I, you know, went to that conference and saw them like, oh yeah, we now have this, you know, positive youth group. You know, you should come to our dinner. So I went to the second dinner that the Positive Youth Outreach Program came. And then from that meeting, found out that Christopher quit afterwards, and then I applied for the job. So they had two dinners, and then I helped conduct the third dinner. So, like, from September 25th, which is when I found out I was positive, by the time January 15th showed up, it was January of the next year I was working at Youth Co.
That's crazy. So,
yeah.
Wow.
I think that's very common. Like, a lot of people that were hired that we worked at Youth Co just were like, all right, let's do it. Like, let's change the world, man. I want to make the world a better place. Like, how can either people prevent other people from getting positive, or how can we, you know, I was just about empowering. I just didn't like the stigma, and I hated that aspect of it. Other people were like, I got to prevent everyone else from becoming positive, and they want to go to schools and teach everybody. I wasn't so big on that. I really felt it was very, I get it why the message is powerful from someone living with HIV to do a workshop like that, but I felt it also very exploitative of youth living with HIV. And we as a non-hierarchical organization, we all have had the same amount of support systems. And I was always be like, you know what? People who are positive, who are doing those workshops, deserve more support than someone who's negative doing that workshop. Because when we leave that table, we're vulnerable because we just shared something very personal with a room of like at least 30 people. When we walk out, we don't have control whether or not they're going to like maintain our confidentiality or not. And I'm like, that just is not cool with me. And So while I started off at YouthGo as a peer outreach worker, I left after a couple of years because my band was going on tour and we were going to Europe and stuff like that. So I quit the job. And then when I came back, they hired somebody else and then they got more funding. And I started working at AIDS Vancouver for a while with Philip Banks. And they got that new funding. The guy that replaced me quit. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'll apply for that. I'll apply for that. And the new job was full time. And it was being a program coordinator. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's way more of it. I'm burnt out being a one-on-one counselor for youth. I was like, but I can do the organizational stuff. And so the last 2.5 years of me working at YouthGo was me being the program coordinator. And then I had two other youth that were the outreach workers. Mm-hmm. So that was our team. Mm-hmm. But I enjoyed being more of that, keeping base, keeping home base, and making sure that that was held before. Because, as expected, as I just said, both of my coworkers end up going on stress leave because they were burnt out. Always, we were the only youth in the whole fucking city who were identified as being positive, who were going out to places, outing ourselves as being positive to meet other youth, which is powerful, but is also very vulnerable, and they burnt out. And so, you know, for months, I was like the only person working in that program, just maintaining our dinners and maintaining our in-house activities, because the outreach work was just, it was too much to be out all the time, I think, and exposing yourself and being by yourself, going to other organizations. It was still, you know, it held a ongoing stress. That's just my critique. That's how I looked at it. Mm-hmm.
And of course, I mean, the stigma at the time would have been pervasive, and I mean, that would have magnified that stress immensely, presumably.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everyone wanted that story because it had, like, you know, a bit of a punch to it, right? Like, we were always being asked, do you have a positive youth that will go on TV and talk about their experience and blah, 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 blah? It's like, I mean, God, everyone wanted that, you know what I mean? And our whole thing was like, how do we create a safe space for our youth and not exploit them? You know what I mean? If somebody wants to do that, we will let them know, but we will not, you know, exploit them in any way. But that wasn't, you know, having to say no was, you know, a big part of the job. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so how did YouthGo kind of change or develop over those years that you were there? It sounds like they grew a lot, for one thing.
I mean, it grew immensely when we got that funding, that's for sure. And then even more funding. I mean, for the youth program, it was, you know, the youth program was seen as a success. And so hence we were able to get, you know, go from two outreach workers to two outreach workers and a full-time program manager. So that was great. We did a lot of, you know, advocacy work too. Like, so again, I was a graphic designer, so I brought in, we had a graphic design team of people doing stuff like that, but I know I brought in aspects of, like, so there'd be the advertisements we would put out in the different papers. We would also do like a little newsletter type of thing to kind of like keep people up to date of like what's going on. I actually found these things. We did these zines. So I did in punk rock world, we do zines all the time. And so they were just like, it was anonymous or not, but you know, our members would like, you know, write stuff and come up with photos, and then we would, or promote, this is Bloodlines, was a documentary of positive youth in Portland. So we would screen that film, and people would write things, and we would photocopy them. And if, you know, this was, I think, our retreat in 2000. So, you know, people would make mock-up funny advertisements from magazines that were promoting some of our drugs, and we'd be critical of them and saying, oh my God, that's crazy, or Dream Hospice Barbie. And it was just silly, irreverent stuff. And then, yeah, we did this one as well. That was number two. And so we did things to kind of, you know, let people, you know, document themselves and have something, documents of themselves that they were a part of, so that they, you know, things that were empowering, you know what I mean? Like, we did workshops. We try to do workshops sometimes, you know, whatever their interests were, you know what I mean? We had a support group as well, where we do like a talking circle, that would happen. We would have the dinner. The dinners were separate. The dinner was just food and socializing. The workshops would be have a focus. Either we'd bring a professional in to talk about a subject that people were interested in, and then we would have a discussion, you know, question and answer period thing, or we would do like the zines, or we would do the retreats. We also had like a big billboard that we did at Virgin Records, which, you know, is where Victoria's Secret is now. But anyway, it used to be a Virgin Records, huge.
Yeah.
And that's how much big records were back then. You know, we had a big display that we, you know, we painted together to put that up, and had a campaign saying, you know, am I HIV positive, on t-shirts to kind of bring up the kind of question to like bring up advocacy and whatnot. So, yeah, it was, you know, we still tried to make some of that kind of activism and raising the voice and advocacy. That was, you know, I definitely, that was good. As it grew, what happened is all the staff started becoming 30, and we all became very conscious that we were getting to be 30 and we needed to, like, move on. And most of us, not all of us, but some of us, we were there because that's what was affecting our lives, but that wasn't necessarily our dreams. Like, you know, it wasn't like, oh, I grew up and I want to be HIV positive and work at a youth organization around HIV and AIDS. It just, that's what happened. And I don't, this is my critique, I don't know if the torch got carried on very well. I don't know if we mentored well enough for new people to come in to carry on that same torch. You know what I mean? Some of those skills, to tell you the truth, aren't skills. Like, they're personality. So you have to remember, except for the first two dinners, you know, I was a consistent voice, and so was Josephine. Josephine was there from day one, from the first dinner. So we were two, like, stable voices for 5 years in that organization. The people that came to that organization, they might even only have come three or four times, some of them. Some of them came way more than that. But I'm saying some people might have only come three or four times in that 5 years, but when they came there, they saw the same face. There was personality, there was community, that you built that. So when we kind of aged out and moved on and did other things, you know, and people were living with HIV now. And so they didn't really need to get support because they weren't concerned about dying. They just like, I would take my pills now. And, you know, I'm not worried about dying. I'm worried, you know, just, I'm just going to take my pills and everything's going to be okay. Like, there was a really big shift, you know, from, you know, 95 to 2000 in those 5 years that I worked there, not just me aging out. There was just so many other things changing, right? It went from incredible need for activism and voices and education and whatnot to I'm exhausted. I now have pills that I can take and I just want to step back for a while. I'm going to live a bit longer now. And I think some of that changed of what people's needs were, you know, or what they were, or, you know, maybe the attitudes around it changed. And yeah, I mean, that was a huge revolution, to all of a sudden have drugs that available that were working. There was drugs the whole time and they were horrible and they weren't working and they had crazy side effects. And then we had drugs that had weird side effects, you know, the protease inhibitors. And then the drugs got better and it was like, wow, like, this is really easy. Like, you could take, you know, like, a couple pills a day. And then they were talking about drug vacations, which wasn't a good idea. But at the time, it was like, you know, we're like, let's see what that's like. And it was just like, all of a sudden, like, it wasn't such a big deal. Everyone started taking drug cocktails. You know, before that, not everyone would take a drug cocktail. It was like, why would I want to get sick and take these pills? You know, it's, they make you feel gross. The old drugs were horrible. Mm-hmm. I took AZT for 2 weeks, and I was like, never again. I was like, that was horrible. So, you know, yeah, a lot of things changed. And so our executive director left. I left. Our, you know, we had a couple changes in the education department over the years. And so, you know, I think its dynamic changed. And then, oddly enough, I don't think there was that many gay men that were working there, too. It was kind of funny. For a while there, it was like everyone that worked there was seemed to be like real, like, political lesbians, which is not, you know, a diss to political lesbians, but, you know, the diversity of the organization became a very different aspect. And I'm not too sure if some of the guys were, like, like, is this organization for me? Because it was shifting through these different, you know, reflecting the different members, the staff hirings and who they could hire. You know, they had trouble finding gay men that wanted to work in the positive youth outreach program, like completely. They just couldn't find people that wanted to do it. They asked me to come back years later. They were like, you didn't come back. And I was like, no. But, you know, like, they just had trouble. I mean, they could find gay guys, but finding gay, positive men that wanted to do that job, for some reason, it wasn't as easy as they thought, I guess. I don't know what the dynamic was. It absolutely changed. And then, you know, some things for better, some things, I mean, it's a completely different ball now. I you know, it changed so many times since I left. I can't even critique. I can only critique what it was like to leave and what it looked like when I left. But, I mean, I don't know. Everyone's trying their best and doing the best they can. So, that's cool. I'm not a youth anymore. I can't critique it.
Yeah, I'm a little bit curious about, you mentioned, like, you know, the diversity of folks from different backgrounds and walks of life and different, like, kind of moments in their life and how YouthCo in those early years navigated that. Because I'm just thinking, like, early ASOs that started off, like, you know, much earlier in the 80s, typically were working with a much less diverse community initially. You know, mostly with gay men. And so, I'm just curious about any thoughts you have around how you navigated that.
What part of the portfolio at YouthCo at the time, I don't know what happened to it later, was diversity. And it was like, how diverse is our organization? And what are we doing to maintain diversity? How is hiring looking at being diverse? So that was always on subject. It was like, you know, how undiverse are we? And how much better diverse could we be? Where can we hire people in positions of power so that we create one, it was non-hierarchical, that a sense where everyone could be present and give them the skills to bring them up there. So we had a lot of, I would say, male, female, when I worked there, a lot of male, female, you know, equilibrium, a lot of people of color working in the organization and volunteering in the organization. I can't say that we always had as great a representation of people with street experience. That was a mandate. Believe me, that was in there. Like, we knew that. But maintaining that was always, you know, a struggle. I think that was a harder position to fill. And understandably, people's life circumstances are a lot more challenging than just volunteering on a board when you're trying to figure out, you know, where the roof over your head is and where your food on the table is. So, you know, I mean, we tried to make sure that we weren't being too happy about ourselves, but at the same time, you know, people have to be open to taking on that criticism and sitting in that uncomfortable position of saying, wow, you know, we'd like to think we're diverse, but are we? Like, so how can we network with all these different organizations? I mean, we were all about networking and partnering. You know what I mean? Whether it was with the Black AIDS Network, whether that was with doing stuff with Urban Native Youth or Healing Our Spirit, or there was a group called Asia at the time. Like, we would just be partnering as much as we could with the organizations so that, you know, that was critical for us to be looking at diversity. Was like, if we can't reflect it, how can we support those who are meeting those needs so that we can, you know, better, you know, to collectively, you know, meet those challenges. So, I think there was effort. I mean, I'm not one to say whether or not we succeeded. I'm a very white middle-class kind of guy. So, but, you know, I think we definitely had that on our radar. We weren't blind to it when we looked at our group and said, oh, this is too many gay white men in it or something like that. It was just ironic. Later on, 5 years, there was very few gay white men in it, and it was like all white lesbians. And I was like, "How? This is the funniest turnover. It went from one to the other." So, you know, I don't know how those shifts happen or how that goes on, but shit happens.
And what was your experience with, I guess, the medical system during those earlier years? Like, you talked a little bit about, you know, trying, volunteering for some different trials. but also I guess like just like your interaction with doctors more specifically or healthcare providers.
Yeah, I mean, right away, I was in the Center for Excellence because I told you, like, I was in that window of opportunity. So I was just thrown into that really quickly. So I just did that. My doctor was specialist was Dr. Conway. He worked with Julio Montaner together, and then they had some disagreement and left. But in the beginning, it was, like, Julio and Dr. Conway. And he just did lots of blood work with me, man. I can't even tell you. Like, it was like, they just wanted samples of my blood all the time because they wanted to be able to monitor this, you know, this period of me, seroconverting and whatnot. I don't know. I mean, I was working part-time. I lived downtown. I was able to do all that stuff because, you know, I worked at a job where I was paid to be HIV positive. So, like, you know what I mean? Like, that was kind of easy to do because that was my job. If I worked in a different organization where I was, like, in the closet about my status, that would have been a lot harder to do. So, I probably have a weird experience with that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, that, you know, it was easy, it was convenient, and it was very well supported. I mean, working at YouthGo was like the first organization I worked at where I was fully embraced as a person living with HIV, fully embraced as a person, you know, who identified as a sexual minority, and like not just supported, but nurtured. You know what I mean? Like, that was a very empowering, again, for a working class kid who worked in factories and warehouses, yeah, that was a very empowering process. And so then to have to go through this really scary thing around HIV and then be like, not only am I going through these tests and doing all this stuff, I'm becoming like a very, experienced advocate for, you know, folks living with HIV while I'm doing this. It's like, this is my job. It normalized it a lot for me, so. I don't know. I mean, it got to a good point where I was good at being vocal and strong about, you know, sometimes my specialists would have interns from, you know, other places around the world who were coming into, you know, whatever you call it, train at the, you know, at the Center for Excellence to get some of their experience and stuff like that. And, you know, sometimes I would, you know, be, you know, very vocal about that I didn't like some of their prejudices or stigmas that they brought to the table from wherever they came from. Because, you know, I remember one doctor who was having to see me before Dr. Whit Conway saw me just started grilling me about my safe sex practices and if I was having safe sex with everybody. And I was just like, I didn't come here for you to lecture me about safe sex. I came here for you to actually give me my test results around how my HIV and my viral load is doing. And I would really like if you kept your moralization about what my sexual habits are or whether or not I'm using a condom to yourself right now, because I don't need that. That's not why I'm here. So, you know, I was able to be a vocal person that way because I already had that background and support. This is my job. I get to do this. You know, and then I would just tell Dr. Conway, I'm like, that person, never again. Like, they do not get to come in my, they don't get to see me. I mean, they're not an asshole. I'm not mad. I'm not, like, crazy mad. I'm just like, yeah, that's not cool. And that's their learning process, right? Is to have me stand up to them and say, yeah, that's not your job right now. But, you know, I recognized in that journey of having to go through a lot of, as a patient and as an advocate, that, you know, sometimes you see a doctor and they're really homophobic. And they might be a professional, and they might be working in HIV and AIDS, but they still have their own fucking issues that they have of discriminating against you based on their own moral beliefs or something like that, that they haven't gotten over, you know what I mean? And so, you know, sometimes, you know, you have to have a bit of a standoff with the doctor that you're seeing and saying, I'm going to see another doctor, you're not that person for me. I think it was already political, so I think that, you know, that kind of just bolstered my comfort zone to be able to speak up around that stuff. But I'm happy that I got to do and speak and you know, I learned a lot about the value of people with lived experience being at the table and having their voices heard. And I think that's a really, really unique thing in the HIV world. I mentioned to you, I think, maybe in briefly passing that, you know, now I'm living with cancer and kidney disease. And I had to sit with some of these professionals on that world. And they are not used to people, patients, being such advocates for their own health. And I'm shocked sometimes how much I have to, like, advocate for myself because they're so used to people just sitting back and just taking what the doctors give them as law. And I'm like, now this is what I'm comfortable with. And they're like shocked, kind of almost, some of the things. But for me, again, since I was 24, it's just sort of like, no, I'm an expert of youth living with HIV, so you have to listen to me. So, you know, that gave me, you know, some sort of confidence.
Yeah, just trying to get a picture of, I guess, some of, like, the larger context here. Well, how was the government responding, you know, in the mid-90s?
Well, it made a landslide shift. I mean, in the early mid-90s, there was still lots of advocacy about making so that we could have access to drugs and have access to, especially, you know, pushing forward for drugs that were, you know, in stage 3 clinical trials and getting people who needed them now to have access to them now. And so there was still, like, when you had an AIDS conference, there was all these activists that would come in and shame the prime minister or shame the health minister for their lack of action. And so, again, that was just kind of expected. It was expected that there would be, like, this big, a part of youth, you know, organizations were, oh, we do education through theater too, right? So there was a lot of creative people in the world who were like, all right, we're going to do this big protest. And it was very fun and cool that way. And it worked. So, then there wasn't really anything to get so upset about anymore. You know, because all of a sudden people had access to drugs and the drugs were working. You know what I mean? Before, when the drugs weren't working, it was like, no, not enough, not enough, not enough, not enough, not enough. I mean, yeah, you know what I mean? I mean, how lucky we were that there were these advancements in HIV to be able to manage that. Going back to cancer again, holy fuck, man, chemotherapy is horrible. It is absolutely like all the horribleness of AZT that I was talking about that I only did for 2 weeks and I had to do for 10 months. And I was like, this is horrible. And cancer's been around a lot longer. And wow, how lucky we were with HIV to have all these advancements with, you know, yeah, in the beginning it was like, oh, you have all these drugs available. Well, that doesn't really make sense. You just made us 3 drugs that we had to take 6. Oh my God, protease inhibitors in the beginning were so lame. They were much better than AZT, but I'd have to take like 18 pills of one drug a day, and they were refrigerated. So like 6 in the morning, 6 in the afternoon, 6 at night. They had to be refrigerated. They could last about your day in your pocket or sitting out somewhere. But the rest of it were bottles, like, you know, a huge bag of drugs in your fridge. And then that was only 1 of 3 drugs. So then you had the other drugs you need to take. So I was taking like 24 pills a day. It was a crazy amount of drugs, refrigerated, the ones I was taking. It was like Sequinavir soft gel cap. I was on that was the study I was on for. And so like when my band went on tour and we were going to Europe, I was like, I am not taking all these drugs, definitely not across the American border. And two, I'm not going to Europe with all these drugs. Like we're going for like 2 months. Like, I can't possibly refrigerate this in a small, shitty van playing punk rock shows. It just ain't gonna happen. But just to give you an idea of how important it was in that time frame, the testing of drugs were, because it was still so new, that Dr. Conway said to me, he would organize it that any major city I went to tour with, I could go to the hospital and pick up my drugs until I got to the next hospital. So he could organize it for me to get my drugs in London or Rome or like Munich, whatever the big cities were, he could organize that for me to pick off pick up what I needed to get to the next one. And I was like, I'm going on tour, and the focus is just getting to the next show, and I really do not need to find the hospital and pick up the drugs. Like, I just, that sounds nice in science, but, you know, in the real term worlds of what I'm going to be doing, but I'm not going to have the time to do that. Like, you know, this is a punk rock band not making any money. I just want to see the world before I die, tour, travel Europe with this band I'm in, and nothing's going to stop that, you know, like that. I'd rather do that than just be taking my drugs, because that was my dream. So, you know, I'm glad I did it, but I was very honored to be given that option of going, okay, wow, this is really important to these researchers, that I stay on this if I can. They'll do anything to make me stay on this trial. But, you know, I didn't. And I just did some other drugs, and they actually ended up doing well for a while. Even though they were kind of substandard drugs, they worked for a while, so it was okay.
And you didn't have any major side effects on any of those early protease inhibitors?
When my boyfriend ate my ass, he said it tasted like a gasoline tank. So, yeah, there were some weird, funny side effects like that. And I would burp up a lot of chemicals and stuff like that. But I didn't have side effects like, I ended up getting some lipodystrophy, but it wasn't actually for the protease inhibitors. They ended up being for the, what was it? B4T, I think it was, that I was taking. They ended up finding out, they didn't know it was a combination of the drugs that started creating some of that stuff. It wasn't so pronounced with me at the time. It was hard to know because I was also 24, very baby-faced. And by the time I was 30, I was taking, you know, all these drugs. And it was hard to know, is this me just aging and becoming, an older person who's in a mature body and losing the baby face? Or is these the side effects of the drugs? You know, you don't have that perspective. When you're an adult, you're just like, this is what I look like. I've changed. But when you're young and your body's still changing, you don't know if it's genetically changing or if it's changing because of the drugs. So, you know, there's a lot more questions when you're younger and taking all these drugs. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. And for that matter, you know, I'm 49 years old, and I was found I was positive when I was 24. So I spent half my life living with HIV now. And, you know, the drugs haven't been around long enough for us to know what is it like for somebody to be actually in real life taking these drugs, and what kind of impact does it have on your system, you know? And so we know people are living longer, but we really don't know the long-term effects of these drugs on people. And, you know, so, you know, and in a way, I'm always a guinea pig. So that's, you know, my life on HIV is a guinea pig. Hmm.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned some aspects of HIV activism, and I guess a lot of the work that you were doing at Youthco can be kind of conceived as activist in nature in a lot of different ways, but were you involved explicitly in any kind of HIV activism work beyond kind of what you've already alluded to?
There was, you know, some really preliminary stuff that happened at the events that, you know, we got to hold placards, you know, for Jean Chrétien about, you know, acting and making drugs stuff more available. But I think the more fun activism probably happened before that. And I, you know, had this weird role where I just started working at YouthGo, and then we had the International AIDS Conference. And this was my opportunity to be networking with a lot of interesting people and trying to get an idea of what it is that my job is. So I felt very overwhelmed to quickly be, you know, in a position where I'm supposed to be gleaning all this information. There was activism happening. Again, we did some simple parts that were easy, but nothing. I never did anything radical. Not that I would say. I think I was really trying to fill in my new shoes and try to figure out what it is that I'm supposed to be doing as, you know, a new hire for a new organization around what are youth living with HIV supposed to be doing at a conference like this to bring back to our, you know, our youth when talking about what came out of that workshop. But so I think I was a bit overwhelmed with all the different sort of being pulled in a lot of different directions at that time. And again, after that, there really wasn't much activism because terms were available. So I just all of a sudden just didn't have that edge to it anymore.
No, that makes sense. So we have some questions kind of that we asked closer to the end of interviews, but William, did you want to jump in and ask anything at this point?
Well, I don't have the interview questions handy, so that's all on you. But the one thing that's sort of like sticking out, I'm not sure how useful it would be, but earlier when you were mentioning zines, did you like flash like an actual zine back from old Youth Co days?
Yeah, that's what I have. I have two of them.
Because that seems like it would be useful in some way or another to like be on some level of record.
Oh, totally. I think that's more than welcome to have whatever, like scan those or whatnot. Because that's definitely a part of the history.
Because for all effective purposes, if I were not to out the history of this project too much, a lot of this project started basically from like a small magazine that Ben found is like there's not enough of this existing like in record. That seems like I can't remember what the Angles, I think it was called, the magazine was called.
That was like the gay magazine at the time, before Extra West came out.
Yeah,
you see? Yeah, and that just sort of like reminded me of that. So I think it would be useful to have some level of documentation on, although I'm not sure how about it would come useful other than like we'll receive the documentation and then think of what to do with it later, which is possibly also questionable on the ethics standpoint, but I think it would be a waste to have that just be another thing that disappears.
I don't know how much you've known about what I'd already had this conversation, Ben, about. I'm actually creating an archive of my personal archive at SFU Library Special Collections that's basically documenting my life as a teenager until now, about all my creative work in music, but also as a queer person and obviously living with HIV. So I'm going to be donating all my materials to SFU. So it'll always be available through SFU as well, under sort of a stream of my collection of stuff. And so whether it be, you know, those zines or some of the other old paperwork I've kept about, oddly enough, I have like my original drug request for AIDS HIV. I have like my original like IDC, like, you know, study patient and consent form that I had to, I don't know why I kept all this shit, but I do. I this is my favorite. Because at the time you had to, like, you know, like prove you're HIV positive, get a lot of services. I still have a doctor's note from my doctor, Fraser Norrie. It says, "Mr. Kinnikin is HIV positive. Please assist him as necessary." So that I could just use that when I was going to an organization that needed to have proof that I was living with HIV. So, and you were talking about activism. This was one of the postcards. It was like killing times, killing people, AIDS action now. And it was like a little postcard and stuff like that. So I have a bunch of these little weird little things that I will be, you know, donating, even, you know, the 1994 Positive Living Manual and their bylaws and constitution of 91 to, they created a Living Positive magazine early on before they changed their name. And there's a bunch of photos of myself and other youth, because we want to make sure youth were represented in it. So, you know, that stuff will all be donated to SFU, and you guys will be able to have access to it once it's there. So, yeah, I like collecting stuff because I've always, as a punk rocker kid, learned that if you don't document your own scene, no one else will, because, you know, punk rock music in the 80s was really not, like, cool. So, like, people weren't documenting it and preserving it in libraries. And now people want to do that, but, you know, a lot of it got thrown away. If you ever find this magazine, though, this is from San Francisco. It's called Disease Pariah News. And this is, like, the funniest magazine in the world. They did this whole thing on Barbie on the back covers where they did KS Ken and AIDS Malibu Barbie Hospice. And no one would ever sue them because they were a bunch of, you know, people living with HIV. And they were so scandalous and irreverent. And they just were hilarious. They inspired our zines because we're like, this is what we can do. It's like, no one's going to sue a bunch of youth living with HIV because they're going to look horrible if they do. So we can do whatever we want because an organization that's going to sue a bunch of HIV-positive youth for critiquing their protease inhibitors is going to, like, look like a real asshole in the end, right? So one of our ads, and I don't know if it's in these, if I have all the zines that we created. I know we created at least two, but there was one hilarious one where it was, like, the drug was one of the protease inhibitors, and they had an ad of people climbing rocks out in, you know, like, I don't know, the Grand Canyon or something like that. And there's a guy helping another guy out, and it's like, whatever the drug name is, you know, like, you know, enjoy the freedom. And one of our members added these little thought bubbles that says, hey, Frank, how's it going? And then a guy below his baby says, I just shit my pants, because it was just making his joke that these drugs had lots of crazy side effects. Like, you know, it wasn't all freedom. Like some of these drugs were making people alive, but they had really crazy side effects. And, you know, the drugs we're using now are way better. So, but, you know, you weren't supposed to critique them because they were giving you money. But we're like, fuck it, we can do that, you know? Are they going to sue a bunch of youth living with HIV? I don't think so. They didn't.
Yeah, that's...
Sorry, I don't, as a sideline from what we're talking about.
No, I mean, I think it's such interesting... like so many interesting historical pieces there. And as like the historian in me is so happy to see that stuff is all going into a collection somewhere. Cause I do think so much of it is so valuable.
I'm really happy I reached out to them that they were interested in it. So cool. And Mr. Take part in this as well.
Of course. William, if other questions come up, don't hesitate to jump in, but I'm going to, just move on to the last couple of questions here.
That's good.
So I guess, you know, since 95, how has your perspective on HIV changed looking towards the present?
Well, presently it's had a huge transition, and that is that, obviously, being diagnosed with, a multiple myeloma, which is a blood cancer, one of the things that I have learned in my new journey is that in our specialty aspect of researching and studying health issues is that we compartmentalize them and we don't integrate the study researches of them. So in my journey with cancer, which is a blood cancer, and of course I have a blood virus, there's no research to say whether or not there's a correlation between me being positive or my drugs that I take having any effect on the fact that my cancer has been really, even though it's not considered an aggressive strain, it has been aggressively attacking me. So the information we have around other health issues in HIV just doesn't exist because everyone's focused in their a specific vision and viewpoint. And once in a while, there's a crossover. And the only research that I've been able to find about the effects of HIV and multiple myeloma are a study that has three cases. And the study says there's not enough evidence. There's not enough data for us to actually do this. We need more research because these three people all progressed really quickly with this drug, this cancer. But we don't know if there is a correlation between HIV or is there a correlation between the drugs they're taking or not. You know, we just don't know, because people with HIV are excluded from cancer trials and people from cancer are excluded from HIV trials. And so, you know, I'm in this crazy situation where my cancer is you know, quite progressed, and it's harshly affected my kidney, but my kidney only operates at 20%. And, you know, 10 years ago, I wouldn't be able to get a new kidney because I had HIV. Well, I can get a new kidney now because I have HIV, but I'm not allowed to get a new kidney now because I have this cancer. And so, you know, my progress with this cancer is limited because it's already taken out my kidney. So when I say taken out, I still have 20% left, but almost taken out my kidney. And so, you know, my biggest, you know, focus around where HIV now is, it's not just getting old with HIV and in the sense of just what aging looks like. It's more like, what's the complications of other health issues and how are they magnified by HIV and or the drugs that we've been taking for 25 years? That information, no one can give me because there's just no data on it. And that frustrates me that, I mean, I expect that to be falling mostly on the world of HIV, because HIV's had so many progresses that they have space to focus on it, where cancer is overwhelmed. Their drug, their advancements, I mean, there's money in cancer, but they haven't had many advancements that are nearly as close to what we've had in advancements in HIV. I mean, it is so archaic, chemotherapy. I'm not doing it again. Like, that's why I'm doing all this stuff, because they're going to put me on, they're going to recommend it one more time, and I'm saying no, like, I'm not going to do it, because it's just too horrible. I just don't see my quality of life being well. So, you know, doing this archive project for SFU, or even doing this interview with you guys, part of this is like, all right, this isn't just time to share my voice, because there's not much time left on my clock. There could be if we had different insights, but there isn't, you know. And, you know, much the same like there was at one point with hepatitis C, that, you know, people couldn't get a new liver because they had hepatitis. And if they had a new liver, then maybe they could live longer. You know, it's going to be the treatments that are going to make the biggest changes, because the organ transplants aren't going to be available. So, you know, the new treatments for cancer aren't enough around the corner to make a change in my life, because the treatments that they need for my cancer require me to have a good kidney, and my kidney has to be above 40%, and it's at like 23, so at best. You know, wow, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I'm happy. I mean, when I was, you know, 24, I thought I was going to live 15 years. So, you know, I've already, you know, lived 10 more years than that. You know, on that perspective, you know, I'm grateful. You know, I'm lucky. But, you know, having said that, you know, we still have a lot of work to do around what does, you know, HIV look like for people who are living with HIV and taking these drugs. We have a lot of great things to prevent people from getting HIV, which is awesome. I'm really happy that, you know, people can, you know, take PrEP and prevent themselves from getting HIV. We still don't know what the long-term effects are of someone who's negative taking PrEP for 20 years. Will they? I mean, they'll probably just stop taking them if they have problems. But when it comes to HIV, people living with HIV and having this, it's not just that, oh, I have cancer and now it's affecting my kidneys. It's like, I have three illnesses and I can only take certain drugs because each drug interacts with the other drugs of the other issues I take. And so I am so precarious in what drugs I can even take to begin with, because it's such a complex case that, you know, I have to have a cancer specialist, a kidney specialist, an HIV specialist, and they're all like, we don't know. This looks like on paper what we think would be the best, but, you know, there's just not much, there's no research or evidence for them to go by. We're just kind of, you know, and if I'm lucky, I'll get some more time, but, you know, I have to be realistic. It could change really quickly. Once the cancer starts coming back, it's just going to go after my kidney again, so. It's not that it's a kidney cancer, by the way. It's just it's a blood cancer, and it toxifies my blood, and my kidney can't keep up with all the toxins in my blood, and so it just toxifies my kidney. So, you know, once the cancer starts kicking back again, it's just going to affect my kidney and or affect my bones. So, you know, it's crazy, you know what I mean? Like, the doctors who were looking at my problems with my kidney were all like, oh, it's probably because of your HIV drugs. We'll change your HIV drugs. And in the 6 months before I got diagnosed with cancer, everyone just went, oh, it's your HIV drugs. We just need to figure out what's going on with your HIV drugs. No one thought to think that it could be something beyond HIV, because they were so blinded by the fact that I was living with HIV. This must be about my HIV drugs. And it's like, wow, what would a difference would have made? Possibly, who knows, maybe not. If we had 6 months ago also said, oh, I don't fit the age bracket of someone who would be not eligible, but considered a target for this cancer. You'd normally be someone who's 65, but who's to say that because I've been taking these HIV drugs, that the target needs to be actually lowered for people living with HIV, so that we're looking for this cancer for people at a younger age, because I got lost in the blind spot. Everyone's looking here and looking here, but there's these two blind spots, and I totally fell through the cracks. And I work in HIV and AIDS world. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, not only was I working in HIV AIDS, you know, I knew all the specialists that were, the HIV specialists that were being consulted, but, you know, no one was thinking cancer. And I think that's what we need to start doing. It's not just thinking cancer, thinking what else can it be besides HIV? Like, if someone's been living with HIV for this long and that's going to become the new norm, what are the other health issues we need to be looking at that are going to be compounding their health and being able to look at that and be a bit, you know, aware of it ahead of time? Because, you know, I'm not the only one, and I won't be the last one either. So, you know, that's definitely, you know, a new kind of insight I have. And also the fact that I worked for two HIV AIDS organizations and neither of them had long-term disability plans for me. So I didn't even get to go into long-term disability. I had to go and apply for disability through the Canadian Pension Plan. And when you're dealing with a cancer diagnosis and having to go through chemo and having to jump through those hoops, I really fucking would have loved to have had my work as HIV AIDS organizations to have had long-term disability so that I didn't have to do that. And so those are my two insights and critiques about the HIV AIDS world, having people living with HIV falling through the cracks.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that with me. And I guess this is like, these are issues that get missed in a lot of the like end of AIDS or end of HIV kind of messaging that we sometimes see out there. There's a lot more, there's a lot of issues that still need addressing in terms of the health of long-term survivors, especially.
Yeah, and that voice will get smaller and smaller as people are, you know, not saying that people say this or that I think this, but there's a part where you're like, well, I'm just happy to be alive. Like, here, I'm alive longer than I expected to be. So I'm not going to complain. But no, we still need to advocate for ourselves, for sure.
Absolutely. And I guess just in terms of any words of wisdom to impart to folks who maybe didn't live through this period of the epidemic, do you have any advice, I guess, for you know, people that might be newly diagnosed today, or you know, younger folks in our communities who just didn't live through this time?
Oh, I mean, I guess, I mean, a part of me just, I'm just trying to think of how some of the issues that I have seen, that some of the advancements that we had in HIV, you know, happened with people who were dying, you know? They were raising their voice and being activists because these are the last months of life that they had left. And to kind of, I guess, value that some of the changes that we take for granted now are because people's lives were at risk and they didn't want to be on the front lines and be screaming. They had no choice, you know what I mean? Like, this is how dire that was. And that's hard to imagine how I really can't think of any other I know that there's talks about discrimination around the pandemic kind of going on now, but I mean, people really didn't give a shit about gay people and drug users and people of color from other third world countries or something like that, or from Haiti. Like, there was just so, it was so not important until it started affecting other people. And this comment that I'm making isn't me making this up. This was a term, and that was when innocent victims were being affected by HIV. And that was the term that was used, innocent victims. And that other people with HIV, by default, then weren't innocent and that they deserved it. But it was the innocent victims, the person that wasn't gay, wasn't a drug user, you know, was white middle class that went for a blood transfusion. They were an innocent victim. And how powerful words are when we forget how we talk about things like that. Whether that be people saying, oh, they're HIV, rather than saying they're living with HIV and not identifying with the disease so that you are the disease, but that it's something that you are living with. The power of our language and our words is still very, you know, we still hold these words and think, oh, are they HIV? And it's like, no, no one is the fucking virus. They just have the virus in them and they're living with it, you know? And having humor, I guess, with it as well. But with all those advancements that we did have, I'm always, for me, I was always very aware when that happened, is the drug companies, they were happy to have their drugs be pushed through quicker so that they could have HIV drugs accessible at an earlier time. They didn't have to wait an extra 20 years of research before it went public. We advocated to have it now, and the government said, okay, let's make it available. And those drug companies, as far as I'm concerned, are still responsible with all the money they fucking make to be doing the research, to be able to affect about why someone like me living with HIV for 25 years has other health complications. And why aren't they footing the bill for that? Because they would have had to fit the bill if we didn't actually make it available that they could jump the key and have the drugs available for us. Sure, we got something out of it. People are living longer. But we also got something out of, lost something out of it, and that is a responsibility for the drug companies to be able to have more research and maintain the research once those drugs became public, to be able to still study and find out what are the long-term effects of people living with these drugs. Because I'm still a guinea pig, and they're not responsible for anything. I'm not saying I want to sue them, but I'd like to at least have some research. That would be nice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not forgetting about that piece.
Yeah, and I think like the HIV activist movement was at times aligned with pharmaceutical companies in terms of like getting these drugs approved, but also like very much, I mean, I think of ACT UP in New York especially, how vocal they were about making treatments affordable and about ensuring that there was access to universal healthcare in the States. Like the tension between, I think, activists and pharmaceuticals has it's been going on for a long time, but yeah, your point about them not doing the they should be doing this research. I agree.
Yeah, they got the money. They're making well, but we have to advocate for it. We have to push for it, and so hopefully we don't. I know there's a lot of battles that we need to fight, and you know we just got through a huge battle getting Truvada being able to be available for people. Who are HIV negative to prevent themselves from getting HIV positive. And I'm really happy about that. But that just doesn't mean that we forget about the people who are living with HIV. You know, I worry now, HIV AIDS organizations are just so being, especially in Canada, by the way, more so than my experience in the States, are so focused on following where the government funding is going that they follow the funding around harm reduction and harm reduction is a part of how we look at education around HIV and AIDS, but it's been, I think, reappropriated to just mean needles and pipes and around drug use. And it to me is only one part of the education aspect of it. And there's so much money with, obviously, with fentanyl going on, that AIDS organizations are just being focused on harm reduction aspects as if that's where all their funding comes from. And we're forgetting that people are still living with HIV and aren't getting their support needs or their research needs. Or there's so many aspects of what people living with HIV still need. And, you know, there's education, there's support, there's, you know, obviously there's testing and there's advocacy. And we focus so much, not just on education and harm reduction, but harm reduction only of education. Like, that's still where all the money's being channeled into one branch of one of the pillars of how we're supposed to be approaching HIV, that we don't realize the table is so tilted on harm reduction. I love harm reduction. I'm a drug user. I've utilized harm reduction stuff. I have no problem with harm reduction, but it can't all just be harm reduction. And I really am worried that AIDS service organizations are just following the funding and not actually looking to see how they can be better actually reaching out to the people who need those other services around support, around testing, you know, around advocacy, that have been lost because we've just been so focused on harm reduction. And again, not belittling harm reduction, but not forgetting about the other other needs in that journey.
And I mean, simultaneously, we've also seen like organizations that cater more to some of those support needs like disappear in the last, you know, in recent months. So I think that just speaks to the necessity of other organizations, existing organizations, filling that gap.
And in Canada, it's a critique that I've heard other people say too, is we rely so much on government funding that it's like, well, that's why organizations do fundraising, so that you could do the work that the government isn't giving you money for and focus on getting money to do what you need to do as an organization, not just the numbers that the government's always going to focus on, you know, what's the crisis at the moment. But we know there's more needs than just the crisis. We have multiple crises. So, you know, how do we look at other ways of cultivating money to be able to do the work that we want to do rather than chasing the funder's needs? How do we start leading where we want our money coming in and where we want it to go? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And fundraising is one of those ways to do it. I mean, it's interesting because you go to the States and HIV AIDS organizations are HIV AIDS organizations, and hepatitis C organizations are hepatitis C organizations. And you know what I mean? Like, they didn't have to meld because our government actually said, you got to meld. That this is the only way we'll fund you. You know, YouthGo, we had to change our mandate if we wanted to maintain getting funding, because we were changing to meet the funders' needs rather than, and I'm not saying that was a mistake. It's like, we're missing out that when we're doing that we're missing out on opportunities where we could be getting money to do what we want to do, not just following the lead. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a bunch of things that got lost in it. And PWA, Living Positive, Positive Living, whatever they were, you know, they just shut down. I mean, they focused just on HIV. They didn't do that. And in the end, they lost, you know, they folded. And I think that's sad, you know. And I don't think it's just that they did something wrong. I just think there's something also wrong with our system and how we fund what is the disease or the health issue of the day. There is always a disease or health issue of the day. And for a while there, HIV was it, and there was lots of money for it, and then it went away. And then it was the next health issue. And, you know, and then it goes through these marketing cycles of, you know, obviously, you know, everything's going to COVID right now. Like, you know what I mean? We know that, without a doubt. But what I'm saying is that there's always something like that and happening. But it doesn't mean the other issues go away. People are still living with cancer and COVID, you know? I mean, people are still living with HIV or a plethora of other health issues, and COVID is just another thing on top of what you already have. So, you know, how do we maintain that? Mm-hmm. Not forgetting. When there's a big wave of whatever issue is, how do we not forget about the other waves that still exist before and after that? Mm-hmm. Am I talking enough?
No, this is great. We definitely appreciate people that are verbose and share, you know, their experiences in depth. That's kind of what all of these, that's what these interviews are really about. I'm kind of out of like my formal questions. I feel like there's probably aspects of your story that we didn't cover, potentially. So, I guess if there's anything that you want to add or clarify at this point, please feel free to do so.
I know I'm a very fluent talker, so I get off topic a lot. And I don't expect me and Beale to say everything in one interview. So, you know, what we captured here is cool. And I'm sure there'll be things I wish I said, but that's just a part of life. And doing an interview is that you try to do more.
Yeah. And like I said, if there's like things that you think of afterwards that are really essential to your story, we can always find time to chat about those things, and document them in a follow-up interview.
Totally.
So that's definitely an option.
What was the last bit? Sorry.
Oh, so that's definitely just an option.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, thank you. This is great. I mean, I feel satisfied, and I'm excited to be able to participate in your project, and it sounds like perfect timing for me. So glad we could do it.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Kim. We really, really appreciate it. William, did you want to add anything else?
I can't think of anything else at the moment, no.
Great. Then we'll just leave it there. I'm going to stop the recording. And yeah, again, thanks so much, Kim.